Mr. Hantees, whenever you're ready. Maybe I should say whenever the court is ready.
Yeah. May it please the court.
Yes, wait one
second. Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Nicholas Hansis, and I represent Infection Control Consultation Services, Inc. My client, ICCSI, which is the abbreviation, was an 8A contractor awarded to perform a pilot program to distribute Twinrix vaccine all over the United States by a government agency known as SAMHSA. GSK is the only company that makes the vaccine, and without that vaccine, there's no program. So it's our position that GSK was a very important player in this. GSK decides that it does not, there's going to be a follow-on contract. My client was awarded the pilot program.
Yeah, I think you can take it that we know the facts of the case. Is your claim interference with the contract, interference with future contractual relationships? Is that, are those your claims?
Yes. My claim has always been it's a claim that of the denial of the follow-on contract.
So is that interference with the contract or interference with the future contract?
Well, it's an interference with the future contract, receiving the follow-on contract. Okay. However, it turns out in this case that the methods of interference with that future economic opportunity were interfering with the existing contract. So we have a situation here.
What's your cause of action?
Cause of action is for interference with the economic opportunity to have the follow-on contract.
So it's the future contract.
That's correct.
Didn't the government contracting officer say that the defendant had nothing to do with the decision not to allow you to have that next contract?
She did say that. And however, there's two reasons. That's essentially the proximate cause argument. They're saying that these repeated acts of interference and the fact that my client, in fact, that the GSK intended to do that had no impact.
But your client did not even apply for this follow-up for the subsequent contract. It was not even IDIQ certified, correct?
That's correct. That is essentially, I think it's very important to understand in this case that the defendants conceded in oral argument, and they do essentially in their brief, that these intentional acts took place and that they did that they also conceded intent. They'd say two words, acts and intent. And the intent was, in this case, that GSK would interfere with my client's ability to get the future contract.
Was your client even qualified for that second, for the contract you're interested in?
Our client was not on the list, Your Honor, but the response to that is this, that my client wouldn't have been selected.
Just let me ask the question. Mm-hmm. Was being on that list a requirement for the contract?
Yes.
Let me get this straight. Being on the select list or that list was required. Your client was not on that list.
Correct.
So how could you get the contract?
Well, because the question is whether my client...
Well, no, that's my question to you. How could they get the contract if they were not on the list? They had to be on to get the contract.
Even if they were on the list, they still wouldn't have been selected.
Well, you don't know that. A condition precedent, sir, is they'd be on the list, and it was up to your client to apply and become certified, wasn't it?
Yes.
And it didn't do the essential step even to be considered for that contract.
That is a part of a proximate cause argument. Essentially, that argument
is... That's what the district court found.
Right, and that argument is that your client negligently failed to look in the journal to see that IDIQ was available for her to apply to. And that is essentially a contributory negligence argument, and a contributory negligence argument is not a defense to an intentional tort.
It's just a proximate cause issue. Is how can you blame? You're saying we didn't get this contract because of the acts of the defendant when you weren't even qualified to get it if the defendant had never existed. I mean, it doesn't have any relationship.
Well, I think you have to turn that around. I think you have to turn that around and say, well, the argument is that our client was precluded from applying because it was not going to make any difference that my client had applied because they had tainted her in the in the in the in the, in in the
But Ms. Perlman
position.
Said that wasn't true, that they adopted this, 90% of the contracts are by IDIQ method, that they adopted it for their own internal reasons, and that your client never became certified to and never applied.
Your Honor, I think it's important to, I think that is...
I mean, is that incorrect, first of all, and that if it's...
No, that's absolutely correct, and I've conceded that, and I've said that in the brief, but I don't think it matters. I don't think it breaks the proximate cause here, because it wouldn't have made any difference. So it's immaterial that she hadn't applied, because they weren't going to pick her anyway, because she had been completely discredited. And Ms. Perlman, who testified, and the government representative who testified, was not a credible witness. And I think that's the credible...
What do you mean she wasn't a credible witness? The credibility in the question on summary judgment, is it?
No.
She answered, and I'm looking at Joint Appendix page 285, and then it runs on to 286. And the question is, in this case brought by ICCSI, it has filed a lawsuit against GlaxoSmithKline, and one of the allegations is that the decision to not award task order proposal, that's your hopeful contract, correct?
Yes.
270-07-0197.
The follow-on contract in whatever form it ended up being,
Is she referring to the one that you're interested in? Is that a reference
yes.
to the task, the contract follow-on. You hope to get?
Yes.
Task order proposal 270-07-10197. Was based on something that was said or done by GlaxoSmithKline. Do you have any perspective on that? Answer, that did not occur. Why didn't it occur? That was not the reason for the decision to go IDIQ, which is the list we've been talking about. ICCSI, your client, did a good job for us. They had a specific requirement that was to do with the kits. They fulfilled that. This was a new requirement that went IDIQ. It's as simple as that. So it's accurate to say that SAMHSA's decision was not based upon anything said or done by GlaxoSmithKline. Correct. And she goes on to say that.
Right.
So she says
that she's got an interest to say that.
Well,
did
somebody else say that it was influenced by the defendant's contacts of any kind?
Well, I think it's important that the court...
If you could answer that question.
Nobody else said that. However, I don't think it matters, and the Fourth Circuit has said in the past that this court has said in the past that it doesn't matter. I cite a specific case involving Hamilton versus Prudential Interest, which was a non-jury case in which the defendant sought summary judgment, submitted an affidavit and asked for summary judgment. The interrogatory answers of that same person were inconsistent, and the court said, well, we need to have a trial because your credibility is
at
issue.
That's the rule there was of the circuit, no, that you can't. That you can't take away a factual dispute by filing the same witness or someone else filing an answer to try to undo that. You can't. That's what that is. The law in the Fourth Circuit is that there has to be a factual dispute on a material matter to get past summary judgment. Here there appears not to be any. Leaving aside the condition precedent, and I think Judge Gergel is exactly correct on that point, but moving the argument to another issue, I don't disagree with the import of his question at all. You have to be qualified to get the contract before you can claim you didn't get it because of somebody else's action. But then on the question of why you did not get the contract, the only evidence I can see in this record is that it was completely unrelated to anything the defendant did.
Well, that
and I've asked, is there anything
yes, there is. There's
to counter
evidence.
That
yes, there
other
is.
Than your claim that she shouldn't be believed?
Well, first off, I mean, if a challenge to credibility means anything, I think it means that if a jury listening to that witness...
It's summary judgment. You misunderstand what credibility determination means. It doesn't mean that the only evidence in the record establishes one fact, and you can defeat summary judgment by saying, but it doesn't matter because I'm going to attack credibility at jury, and the jury might believe
that. That's not the argument I'm making. Because they concede in their brief that there's intentional acts, that they were done for the purpose of causing SAMHSA not to pick my client, and those facts in themselves are affirmative evidence.
What intentional acts are they? Do you say they assert that they took steps to keep you from getting that contract?
Well, they conceded in oral argument. They conceded in oral argument that there were disputed facts on both intent and act. And because they conceded those, the court the district court was required to assume those facts were true because they conceded the acts were taken and they conceded also intent.
They conceded that there was a dispute as to whether or not they did something to that they did. In other words, they say there was a dispute of fact as to whether or not they took steps to keep the government from giving you the contract?
Correct.
Show me where that is in the record.
I will.
No, you can find it. I don't want to disturb. Go ahead and find it.
Look, it's in volume 3. And
maybe he could find that and bring it up on rebuttal.
Yeah, it might be helpful.
I'll do that.
Counsel, don't you mean in the sense what they're saying at summary judgment stage, they're saying, yes, they must, as the moving party, assuming what you said is true, that they did something to hurt you, the fact that it had no impact on you or not getting it doesn't make any difference. Wasn't that what basically the context you're talking about?
Yes, and I'm saying that if they conceded those things and I wasn't going to get the site, then a reasonable jury could find if they believed that the acts were taken and that GSK took them for the purpose of interfering with my client's ability to get the job, that creates...
But as I understood the question, there's a difference between assuming for the point of argument and conceding. Do you think there's a difference between that?
No, they conceded it. In this, I don't know if there's a difference, but I know what they did in this case.
There is a difference.
Yeah, there is a difference, but in this case, they conceded it.
The purpose of this motion, mm-hmm. assuming your facts are correct in that aspect.
That's correct.
But they're not conceding it.
They're not conceding the trial. They're going to contend differently.
But the question is this, what is the evidence that the awarder received this negative? And because they said it wasn't the tank that caused it. So what's the evidence that they received it?
Well, Ms. Perlman testified that she was aware of all these derogatory things, that she had heard that our client had supposedly and falsely over-ordered 7,000 vaccine. And I think it's very important here to look. There really is a document that demonstrates clearly that Ms. Perlman was, in fact, influenced. If you look at the September 29, 2006 email.
The decision to go IDIQ had already occurred on September 13th. So the September 29th. Email is irrelevant, isn't it?
No, because the IDIQ went out on September.
Am I right about the dates, by the way?
Yes, September 13th is the date of the IDIQ, and you had 30 days, so there were still 10 more days, and they didn't even tell my client that they had issued the IDIQ, which I think is very important evidence. My client is still finishing the pilot program. They put it in the newspaper, but they don't tell her, oh, by the way, we've issued the IDIQ. And I think that evidence is very important.
Are they required to do that under the rules?
They're not required, but it tells you what the impact of GSK's repeated statements were, that they weren't going to pick her. And that's why I say, when you ask Judge Gergel, you say, well, isn't it critical that your client didn't apply? My response to that is, they didn't want my client, and evidence that they didn't want her, and so it doesn't make any difference. The decision had been made, they weren't going to have her, so that's something that happens after the fact. They weren't going to use her. And if you look at that email, Mr. Lubrin says, how can we continue to do business with her if she over-orders vaccine by 7,000? That's an indication that the GSK false accusations are having an impact. That's what that email, so that when she comes into court 3 years after the decision made and states, it didn't have any impact on me, there's a prior inconsistent statement, which is her own email, and that's a critical argument in this case. That her own prior inconsistent statement of saying that her over-ordering has the impact on us of questioning her business acumen is a prior inconsistent statement which would cause a reasonable jury not to believe her testimony 3 years later. She's an interested person. She wants she needs GSK in order to continue that program. So she's not a disinterested person. She wants the program. And if GSK doesn't want our client, then the government doesn't want our client. And I think her real position is set forth in that prior inconsistent statement. And I'm going to get that quote and come up for my last 5 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hanson. All right. Mr. Blumenthal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michael Blumenfeld on behalf of Smith Beecham Kline Corporation, doing business as GlaxoSmithKline. This is a very straightforward case, only complicated by appellant's efforts to create a genuine dispute of material fact.
He says you've conceded facts in this case that would lead to the inapplicability of summary judgment.
I understand that that's appellant's position, but Judge Gregory is correct. At oral argument, in which I was the attorney responsible for the oral argument, a question was posed to me regarding intent. And my answer to Judge Titus was essentially, Your Honor, if we get into intent, it's obvious that I'm going to suggest that GlaxoSmithKline didn't act with improper intent or tortious intent. And then appellant's counsel is going to stand up and suggest, I don't believe that assertion. Of course they acted with tortious intent, and then we would have a material dispute of fact. But the court doesn't need to look at intent for the very reasons that this panel has already discussed. The tortious interference with prospective advantage claim, in this situation, there are no damages. The appellant didn't respond to the request to become an IDIQ contractor. Your Honors have correctly hit the nail on the head. Had they responded to that request, had they participated in that process, they then would have been eligible to respond to the RF, what they call a rooftop, a request for task order proposal, to do this 2007 initiative. But they never did that. There's nothing in the record. There's absolutely nothing in the record, no testimony under oath, whether by affidavit or by deposition, that suggests anything to the contrary. In fact, as Your Honors have pointed out, Susan Perlman, let's take a look at who she is. She's the Director of Procurement for SAMHSA, which is a sub-agency of the Department of Health and Human Services. She has 30 years of government procurement, government contract.
What about their claim that their failure to get on, it's easy to get on that IDIQ list, isn't it? In that testimony in the record, I thought I saw that it's fairly easy to get on the list.
It's an application process, that's correct. And then the government or this sub-agency will divide you into categories.
Well, I didn't ask you all that. I said, based on the record, is it fairly easy to get on that list?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, that's what I asked you.
Yes, Your Honor.
So, but they claim that then you're trying to write on the question of contributory negligence, that you did, in fact, interfere with them getting that future contract, add-on contract. But we're all talking about the same thing.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that you can't, that your actions can't be excused just because of some issue of contributory negligence that they may have had. You say what to that?
I say that the defense of contributory negligence hasn't been asserted by GlaxoSmithKline. It's simply an undisputed fact that the appellant voluntarily elected, to not participate in the process. Now, appellant...
So you're just saying, in your looking at the facts, in your defense, you're not asserting contributory negligence. You're just saying there's no cause of action at all.
Correct. Absolutely, Your Honors.
What about the prior inconsistent issue? You know, we've asked about what evidence there is in the record, other than you heard me read the transcript.
Correct.
I'm sure you're familiar with that, aren't you?
Absolutely.
And you were familiar with it before I read it, I bet, weren't you?
I have it right here at my fingertips.
Right. So with that being the case, they say there's a... You know, listen, you understand the law is, if there's only one position taken on a fact issue, the fact that somebody wants to contest that or attack credibility in front of the jury, that's insufficient to defeat summary judgment. You agree with me on that, don't you?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Let's deal with the prior inconsistent issue, that he says there's a prior inconsistent statement in the record. Which statement caused some question about, which disputes this issue that she said that GlaxoSmithKline did nothing to, on which she based her decision? What about that?
Well, I think Your Honors have already picked up on why that's not...
When I asked you that, I asked you to answer it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the statement was made by Robert Lubrin, not Susan Perlman. Robert Lubrin did not make the decision. Susan Perlman, the undisputed testimony by Susan Perlman is that she made the decision. So that's the first reason. The second reason is it's not sworn testimony. It's an email that Mr. Lubrin was questioned by appellant's counsel at length at deposition. And each and every time he answered the question...
Does a prior inconsistent statement have to be sworn?
It does not have to be sworn, but it's not an inconsistent statement. The statement is a conditional statement. If the appellant can't perform accounting, these accounting functions, then we would have a concern with doing business with them if they can't do it, not they can't do it. When questioned, but when Mr. Lubrin was questioned by it and when Ms. Perlman was questioned about that statement, they both said that GlaxoSmithKline did not do or say anything, as Your Honor has pointed out, to cause them to either award the contract through the IDIQ process or inhibit their desire to work with them in the future. There's no other testimony in this case. There's no other witness other than the plaintiff who says, I disagree with that. And this, as Your Honors have pointed out, this circuit has said that you don't create a dispute of fact by arguing that there's credibility issues because the plaintiff or the appellant doesn't agree with the testimony. That can't be enough. Under that theory, defendants could never get summary judgment.
Yeah, the award never said that your client didn't make any communications to them, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't.
They never said you didn't say anything to them at all. They never asserted you never said anything to them.
GlaxoSmithKline had communications with the government. That's correct.
Right. It would be inconsistent if you had said, well, we never even talked about it because that's a reference that maybe they made some as for the ordering, over-ordering. But the question is as to the cause, they said, had nothing to do with the decision.
Absolutely. That is correct, Your Honor. There's absolutely the only two independent.
But I take it, had there been some communication, if you had denied communications and there had been communications, I suspect you would be standing in front of us arguing that was a factual dispute about an immaterial matter.
That is correct.
Then it might be up to us to decide how you could maybe think of a way to use that to undercut her or to create a factual dispute about what she said. Perhaps you could, I guess.
That is correct. I think the argument in the lower court and the argument here today is, at the end of the day, the appellant can't satisfy the essential elements of the tort. There's a causation problem and there's a damages problem. So even if we assume the facts in favor of the non-moving party.
Why do you say there's a damages problem?
Because there's no damages if we know why the contract wasn't awarded.
But that's a causation problem.
Correct.
But where's the damages problem?
Well, if the appellant isn't eligible for the contract that they seek.
That's a causation problem.
Correct. But if they're not, what I'm trying to say.
Where's the damages problem?
From appellant's perspective, the contract was worth a couple $1 million. If they're not eligible to be awarded anyway, they can't.
But that's not a damages problem. They could show damages that somebody else got that contract and they didn't. I think it really is a causation problem. And the only way I can see that it's a damage problem is there can't be any damages if there's not a causation.
Correct.
Is there an independent damages problem in this case that they could not show damages if there had been causation?
No, Your Honor. I think the way you've articulated is probably more appropriate.
But, you know, this issue about I know there are several communications, there are issues, one of them being the 7,000 units of the vaccine. But, of course, in business, there are going to be misunderstandings, Mr. Blumenthal. Are there not from time to time?
Yes, sir.
And the issue here was that the plaintiff was ordering from one county, an account attributed to one county, thousands of vaccines all across the United States, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And it created an understandable suspicion that their discount they were getting was being applied to other clients. That was the issue, wasn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And eventually it was sorted out and it was concluded that there was this nationwide contract and it was appropriate, but looking at that September 29 email, that's sort of in the middle of the discussion. By the end, everybody understood that really wasn't a problem, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Including Ms. Perlman testified that it wasn't a problem.
That is correct. There are only two independent witnesses in this case. Both have testified very clearly. Your Honors have picked up on their testimony. There's absolutely nothing else in the record to contradict their testimony. With that, Your Honors, I would be happy to answer any additional questions, but I think we've flushed it out.
I think we understand your argument, Mr. Blumenthal. I'll be fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hanses?
Excuse me.
The citation where the defendants conceded that issue is 1454, 1456. And what counsel says is the court, the district court asked the question, and running throughout the theme of all these cases, this is the district court talking, cases of the Court of Appeals, is that this is not, is that this is not intended to stifle competition, and that's why in the second branch of the tort you see references repeatedly to improper and improper or unlawful means. I mean, it's got to be something really bad to do that because it's anti-competitive otherwise. I mean, that's what I've seen from the cases I've litigated before, and I know from the bench, I think I have some understanding. Mr. Blumenfeld, I agree with the court with your analysis. This is, that's the issue. Now, I've stayed away from that because I think the plaintiff is going to, what the plaintiff is going to do, he's going to stand up and he's going to give you other facts in this case that are disputed. So he's going to get up. Counsel is going to get up and tell you that there are all kinds of bad things that GlaxoSmithKline did. Those are disputed. The intent is disputed. And that would create a material fact, a dispute of fact. And I don't think, and the reason I haven't focused on that is I'm focusing on the damage issue because I think that the there's nothing in the case that suggests that Glasgow caused the damage. So he is conceding that those are disputed issues of fact, which the court must accept as true for purposes of summary judgment.
He's simply observing that your characterization of intent and the defendant's characterization of intent are different, and he's saying it doesn't matter, they're disputed facts, but they're immaterial.
Right, that's right. Yeah. But they're not immaterial. They're directly related to proximate cause because the question for proximate cause and the affirmative evidence of the proximate cause is that evidence that he concedes because it's a material, because he's conceding that GSK intended to interfere with my client because he said intent is interfered. And if you intend to interfere with my
that's
client.
Not, that's not what that says. That's not what he says. I will suggest what he says the question of damages. I suspect he was using damages the same way he just used it. And maybe not quite as precisely, but he says causation.
Is
he says causation. He didn't say there's a dispute about causation.
No, he does not. I agree with that. But because he concedes that they intended to interfere, a reasonable jury could find that if those acts are true, if those acts are true, and they did intend it, that in fact it caused the caused the harm.
I was saying, counsel, that he's basically saying that. If you get caught up with this intent thing, then you could somehow find some disputed fact and say summary judgment is not appropriate, but that's really not the issue because it's causation. And you, even if you could show intent, you can't show the causation because the actor, the awarder, is the disconnect. But no matter what they did, whatever their intent, it had no impact. And that's the I think but that's not a concession for merits.
Well,
it
directly responds to the argument that all we're trying to do is undercut the evidence of credibility because that evidence that's conceded is evidence that would support that there's proximate cause. If somebody intends to harm you.
No, undercut the question of causation as to her determination, her testimony. Nothing, just as Judge Gregory just in his question, I think, points out, the import is if he does or does not concede on points that don't matter to his case, it doesn't affect the issue that does, in fact.
It does. I think it does, and I think that's where I disagree with the court. Okay. Because if you make those concessions, if somebody puts on evidence and the jury believes that GSK intended to keep our client from there, the jury could also find that because it did have the effect intended.
Yeah. Let me ask you this question. What if the facts in the case were this? Mm-hmm. These aren't the facts, but if they were.
Mm-hmm.
What if the defendant said, we're going to tell you this, Your Honor, we wanted to stop them from getting a contract. Mm-hmm. It was our corporate policy. We drafted a letter at the board of directors, and we want to mail it to the government to say they should not give the contract to the plaintiff. But the clerk who was in charge, and I used the clerk who was in charge, forgot to mail the letter. And it's undisputed the letter was never sent, but it absolutely was our intent to interfere. And then the testimony is from the government.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what their policy was. We didn't know what their policy was. We made a determination on independent facts. So there is intent. Do you think that gets you past summary judgment on causation?
I'm
just asking that simple question.
I wouldn't get by. Except the difference in your hypothetical is that the clerk, Perlman, knew about those acts in our case, and she admits it. And more importantly, if you look at her email, which is on 977.
I think you got the clerk misplaced in the hypothetical. But
I'm sorry. Will Ms. Perlman do it?
That was the would-be messenger, but that didn't make the delivery. But that's okay.
Okay. Well, but I think Ms. Perlman knows about it in this case. And I also,
what if I counsel, I'll go another further with Judge Shea's fine hypo. What if the clerk did deliver it? Mm-hmm. But the rewarder said, "Yeah, I see this. This is, makes no difference to me. I'm going to follow what our normal procedures are." I said, "That's what we did." Do you have causation there?
Yes, I do because I asked you this, the decider. That's the word, so I'm not confused about the clerk. I'll say the decider. The decider says in an email, she says one thing in testimony 3 years later, but in her email at the time, which is on 977, Mr. Lubin writes to her and says he has concerns about how we can do business in the future with somebody who overorders vaccine.
That's not her email.
Right?
His email, Mr. Lubin's email, and it's 14 days after they've already decided to go the IDIQ.
No, well, they've decided to go that way, but it's still open. She can still apply. She's got 30 days to apply after September 13th.
But they don't.
She didn't. That's correct. But then in response to this email from Mr. Lubin, Ms. Perlman says, Mr. says, I'm assigning somebody else to this contract. And she's assigning, taking off Mr. Main, the person who had originally awarded it, and now she's taking action directly in response to this. It's our contention that there was a sufficient evidence by virtue of those concessions that a reasonable jury could find proximate cause. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen.
I don't need one, but whatever you want to do, Roger.
Are we going to come down to Greek Council and proceed?